Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Following World War II and the collapse of European imperialism, many former European colonies in the Middle East and North Africa found themselves immediately challenged with the task of setting up new governments to rule their territory. Despite having populations that were predominantly Muslim, most of the new governments that emerged tended towards secular authoritarianism, often taking a corporatist or soft fascist form, wherein the autocrat rulers would set up a single political party to mobilize support and/or organize various social organizations, such as labor unions, in the effort to forestall any opposition. Regimes such as Abdel Nasser's socialist-leaning dictatorship or the single-party Ba'athist regimes in Syria and Iraq represent the quintessential examples of this. But over the past three or four decades, these secularist-ruled nations started to experience religious awakenings, giving rise to Islamist movements that directly challenged the basis of secular governance. How these movements have emerged and what effect they are having on politics in the region today, especially in light of the Arab Spring, has become of great interest to scholars as of late. Today, we take a look at the interesting case of Morocco, a country that often goes unnoticed because of all the attention focused on Libya, Egypt, Syria, and Iran. Nonetheless, lessons learned from this nation on the northwest coast of Africa may be illuminating for understanding the large social and political trends transforming the region as a whole. I am pleased, therefore, to be joined by Anne Wainscott, a graduate student at the University of Florida who is completing her dissertation on the politics of educational reform in Morocco. I had the great pleasure to meet Anne during a recent trip to the University of Michigan, where she presented her research in poster form for a select group of scholars invited to a conference on religion, identity, and politics. I should also note that Anne is only the third graduate student to appear on our podcast series, which now has over 150 episodes in our archive. I not only like to highlight the top scholars in the field of religious studies, but also people who are at the outset of their careers and who are poised to bring a new way of thinking to the table. So, Anne, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. I'm happy to be here.
If I get this correct, from discussions with you and from reading your material, you initially started to do fieldwork for your dissertation on educational reforms in Morocco. And your topic was pretty narrow, as most dissertations tend to be, and that's usually based upon advice by a seasoned scholars, keep it pretty narrow and stuff. But then something interesting happened to you when you were studying Arabic that had the effect of expanding the scope of your dissertation. Tell us that story.
Well, I have been studying language at the Arabic Language Institute of Fez in Fez, Morocco, for years. I began there in the summer of 2006, and so I had a long-running relationship with this program and with the teachers at the institution, and I had thought that maybe they had run out of surprises for me or that I had gotten hang of things, but on one particular day during my dissertation fieldwork in 2010, so after I had been studying at the school on and off for 4 years, my one of my favorite teachers, Hamid, he's a real politologue, he's always reading the newspaper, or sipping espresso and smoking cigarettes while reading every political blog he can get his hands on.
Wait, did you said a real political log?
Yeah, that's like a French term. Like he is like addicted to politics. I remember once he came into class horrified that I hadn't stayed up until like 3 in the morning to watch Obama's State of the Union so that we could discuss it in class the next morning.
Okay. I learned a new word here, political log. So that's good.
Yeah. So one day, you know, we were waiting for him in class, and this was strange because he was always on time, and in fact was usually early and down at the espresso bar at the language school. And in this case, he kind of stumbled up the stairs late for class into the classroom, and was carrying like his espresso on top of a stack of books, you know, rather disheveled. And he made quick mention of the fact that he was late for class because there'd been a knife fight at the university where he worked, and since he was in his classroom and the knife fight was in the hallway, he had to wait until they were done before he could leave the room.
Wait, did you just say knife fight?
Yeah.
With sharp blades and everything. Oh, my gosh.
Well, you have to keep in mind that most people don't have guns in Morocco.
Okay.
They're legal. So when people want to have some sort of violent altercation, they revert to the things they have access to. And he didn't think this was interesting at all. So he just mentioned the knife fight quickly and started class. And I was, shocked, and I took a minute to collect myself, and then I raised my hand to ask him, for more details. And I said, who was having this knife fight in the classroom? And he looked at me kind of, surprised or maybe even a bit irritated, well, the Islamists and the leftists, of course. And then he kept going into class and started the day's lesson, and I had to interrupt him again to really get the details of this. And I discussed this event in the dissertation because I really feel like it highlights how what is common sense to me and what was common sense to a lot of the people who I was doing interviews with was different. And so this colored the research because I had to not only research the subject I was in, but really force people to give me more details than they wanted to because they thought things were obvious.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things that when you go to a different country to do field work, many people will criticize you saying, well, you're not of the culture, so you can't really understand things. But there is the obverse situation where you come in with fresh eyes and you see things that you scratch your head and say, well, that's odd. Why should that be? And so, I had the same experience in Chile. I was calling attention to a lot of things that people thought were regular occurrences or everyday things, and I said, no, this is kind of unusual if you go to other parts of the world.
Well, absolutely. That was the conversation I got to have with this professor, that in the American context, if there's violence at a university, this is front page news.
Yeah.
And it's something that's really talked about, whereas in the Moroccan context, it's so normal that people don't even think it's worthy of mention. He didn't even want to tell me who was fighting because it's so obvious to him.
Yeah, so you get this battle between these Islamists and leftists, and it's a normal occurrence there. They don't think very much of it. Just out of curiosity, did this concern you at all? I mean, here you are, a Westerner. You do not look Moroccan. And you're red hair, so you stand out, and you're saying, wait a minute, this is happening in the halls every day? Did you get a little bit worried or nervous?
I didn't, but I think at that point I was really tired, honestly. When you work in a foreign country and you have to code switch or switch languages frequently, it takes a lot of mental energy. And so at the time, I don't think I could even follow through the logic that far. I was just, one, so boggled that that political groups, this is not gangs, these are political parties who have student organizations on campuses, are working out their ideological conflicts through violence. This was so beyond what I could understand that I didn't take it to the next level to have any concern for myself. And soon after this incident, of course, we had protests beginning in Egypt, in Tunisia, and the atmosphere got very tense. And at that point, I started to take maybe safety more seriously. But at this time, it was still early in my field work. I'd say it was about November of 2010. It wasn't on my radar. I'd been working in Morocco since 2006 on and off, and I had never had any experiences that made me feel unsafe. So.
Yeah, one of the things that you mentioned just a moment ago was that this was between two political factions of student groups there on the campus, the Islamist and the leftist. And we're going to get to that and cover a little bit more of who those factions were. But pretty admirable of you that you just kind of kept on keeping on. And I guess since you're not part of either of those camps, you're somewhat safe in that regard. So I always advise my graduate students, don't get yourself killed doing your dissertation. That's the number one rule. So if you can do that,
that'll really stall your research program.
It will completely stall the research program. So it's good that you did not get any knife fights. We're going to figure out what all this knife fighting was about. But let's really rewind the tape a little bit. And I want to trace out your dissertation trajectory. So this is a little bit of informational background about you, because before that incident, you were doing something a little bit different, not extremely different, but a little bit different. You were out there studying just educational reform, correct?
Right. I was interested in how the 9/11 and 2003 environment influenced educational politics. In 2003, Morocco had its first experience of what we would call like terrorist violence or terrorist bombing in Casablanca. And I was interested in how did this politicization of Islam affect the Islamic education curriculum in public schools. So in Morocco, they have religious education alongside math, science, social studies, Arabic, French, in the public schools. And I'd always imagined that the creation of a kind of national religious education curriculum had to be pretty contentious in and of itself. I think of the American context. Can you imagine the conflict if there was one Sunday school curriculum for, you know, every church in America? It would be highly controversial and a huge ideological battle. So the original interest was just how did this kind of rise in interest in the relationship between Islam and violence in the global context, but specifically in the Moroccan context after this experience in 2003, how did that influence these debates that were going on about reforming religious education in the public schools? And that was the original project, and that's the reason that I was in the field in 2010 and 2011. And it was through my field work that I really got a sense. I mean, I literally had, you know, people who were more informed on the subject than me say, like, "Anne, you're missing something. Like, you're starting the story in 2003. It starts long before this." And honestly, I didn't really understand what they were saying until I was back from the field. So in the fall of 2011, when I was going through my field notes and you know, reading interview data and thinking through the issue myself, did I realize that if I started the story in 2003, in a sense, I would, you know, do harm to my research subject. I would mischaracterize the reforms of the post-2003 period because they are playing out a much longer narrative than just the politicization of Islam in the 21st century. This subject was politicized in Morocco long ago, and I would go all the way back to the nationalist movement in the 1940s and 1950s, and I do.
And we're going to do that in a second, but I want to pause here a minute because this is a great lesson for researchers, either graduate students or seasoned researchers. We'd mentioned before that you come into a country from a different culture and you have fresh eyes to see things differently and to scratch your head and say, that's odd. But on the other hand, what you also just said is that being an outsider, you oftentimes miss a lot of the cultural subtext that is going on. And you were fortunate enough to have some people, some confidants who are saying, listen, you're just looking at educational reform. You got to dig deeper in this. So a good methodological lesson there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is your thesis now? So you're going to start at 2003, but now we're going to go back to the 1940s. Just in a nutshell, and we'll start to disaggregate this by going back in a temporal sequence and starting in the 40s or 50s. What is your general thesis now?
I argue that the rise of the left in Morocco, so communist and socialist movements, made themselves known to the Moroccan regime in the 1960s, and specifically through the events of the 1965 Casablanca riots. And these events demonstrated to the regime how powerful the left had become and how important educational institutions are for fighting out ideological conflicts. And I look at how education in the post-1965 period was used to influence ideological conflicts between opposition movements, and specifically how the left was really reined in, one scholar calls it exhausted, by educational reforms, which encouraged Moroccan students to see Islam as a political ideology and to take on Islamist political leanings in order to not become leftist or to discourage them from being communist or socialist. And then I trace it all the way through to the 21st century, where we see there's a need for a reversal, right? The Islamists become too powerful. They're too united as a political force in the Moroccan context for the regime's taste. And then there's this effort to pull back, to discourage the politicization of Islam. And in the post-2003 period, which we were discussing earlier, there's this real effort to depoliticize Islam, to focus on what I would call human rights or civil rights values like tolerance, forgiveness, communication, and to remove Islamic content from a number of subjects in the public schools. So if I had to sum it up, I would say, you know, I argue that the 1965 Casablanca riots constitute a critical juncture in the history of Morocco. They set a new trajectory for the country. They encouraged the regime to become very involved in monitoring and directing education as a form of control of the opposition, and they had unintended consequences that the regime is now trying to address using the same methods, using educational reform.
Yeah, this is one of those dissertations that I love, and I'm glad you used the word unintended consequences, because you do set the policy up, and then all of a sudden it takes on a life of its own, and people behave in ways that you didn't expect them to. And the other thing that I really like about your dissertation, too, is that a great deal of the discussion about Islamism today often focuses on social characteristics or demographic factors, you know, increasing poverty or gap between rich and poor, things like this. But you actually trace this to a specific policy decision or set of decisions that dates back several decades.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't want to overplay the educational aspect of this, because I see educational reforms in the Moroccan context as part of a large, coordinated project to control public discourse that had multiple factors. So, you know, the jailing of dissidents, the disappearance of opposition figures, the closing down of newspapers, the regulation of all sorts of forms of public discourse, not just education. But as you said, you know, PhD committees really like narrow dissertations, and so I decided to focus on the education element of this, but I don't want to say that it was the only aspect. It was part of this larger coordinated strategy, but I think it demonstrates the overall trend towards which groups were supported and which groups were opposed.
Yes,
then how that policy shifts over time.
Yeah, that's a wise choice, because there are two types of dissertations, finished and unfinished.
And everyone says
yeah,
that.
You want to have the finished type, and the wider you expand your scope, the more likely you are to have an unfinished one. But again, you expanded it, I think, in a very effective way to capture more of what is going on, but still focus on this issue of educational reform, which, by the way, political scientists don't focus on very much. And so that's really nice. Before we go and explore educational reform in Morocco and what is going on in the political landscape presently, and also, I should say, and also thinking about what it is occurring region-wide and how your dissertation speaks to that, I just want to start to focus on Morocco, because admittedly, I know very little about Morocco other than what I've seen in the movie Casablanca, which I've only seen snippets of. I've never seen the whole thing. And I know that Morocco was the site for U2's video for the song Mysterious Ways back in the early 1990s or something like that. So give us a little bit of historical and political background on this Northern African nation, perhaps starting where you start with your dissertation in the immediate aftermath of World War II.
Well, I focus on a split in the nationalist movement, which is at the beginning informal and just debating among the executive committee of the Nationalist Party, who was fighting for Morocco's independence from the French in the 1940s and 1950s. And after independence in 1956, the Nationalist Party, in effect, comes to power. Now, they don't have a lot of actual effective power, but they are the winner of elections, so we'll put it that way. And this party eventually will split formally. They split effectively in 1959 and then formally on paper in 1975 into two factions. One goes by the name of Istiklal, or the Independence Party, and their governing ideology is Islamic modernism, which is a form of interpreting Islam that focuses on how can we both, you know, take hold of scientific advances and also restrain the importation of ideologies from outside of the Islamic community into Morocco, and then, of course, socialists or leftists. And in the 1960s, the kind of significant events are, in 1961, the king, who was really the symbol of the nationalist movement in the 1940s and 1950s, passes away unexpectedly in 1961. And his son, Hassan II, comes to power. And it, in a sense, changes everything, because Istiklal, the governing party, had made some kind of tacit agreement with the Muhammad V that were supposed to lead to a constitutional monarchy that were never codified. And in the uncertainty of a young country, 1961, Morocco was only 5 years since independence, a ruler who, in my opinion, had some, you know, self-esteem issues. He was pretty, paranoid and skittish. In this context, everything changes, and he becomes very authoritarian. And the thing that's significant, I think, for your program is that you can look at the reign of Hassan II in the 1960s and see his move from what I would say is a leftist, French-educated, secularist ruler to someone who really sees religion as a resource for an authoritarian regime, and who slowly takes hold of, institutionalizes his control over religion. So, for example, in the 1956 Constitution, the king doesn't have a formal religious role in the same way he does in the 1962 Constitution. I'm basing this on the work of Abdullah Tarabi. He's a Moroccan scholar. And today, and when you hear the Moroccan monarchy talked about, there's this frequent mention of how the king is the Mu'ammar al-Mu'minin, or the commander of the faithful. He's the supreme religious leader in Morocco. But this role isn't actually codified until 1962. So there's this period where Morocco really could go in a secular direction, and doesn't. And then there are a host of other things that I can mention, but the important thing for your program is, right, there's this realization that religion is a resource, and it can be used to pacify or to control people. And we see in the Moroccan case in a number of ways how religion is taken on. And I, of course, focus on the educational side.
So tell me a little bit about what the government looks like in its first 5 years, the 1956 Constitution. Is it looking like a constitutional monarchy at this period of time?
It's looking like a young country that's working things out.
Okay.
There is a constitution. There is a cabinet. I would say that Muhammad V, the king at that time, took his advisors more seriously, or the cabinet more seriously than later regimes. So I think perhaps political parties were more powerful in that period than I would say they were in later periods. With Hassan II, political parties were really just a stamp for all of the 60s, 70s, 80s. They really took tremendous risk if they took a stand against the regime. And so there would be like minor squabbles in that period. But under Muhammad V, I would say there's more substantial conversation about like what should policy look like. And there was more open debate. And that openness would close slowly over the 60s.
Now, during that initial five-year period when there was more open debate, did the socialist, the leftist, have a little bit more sway, or was it the Islamic modernist, or was it a pretty even balance?
Well, Islamic modernism is the foundation for the Independence Party, Istiqlal, mm-hmm. and the party hadn't split yet. And the primary leader, or the leader who really had who was kind of seen as a symbol of the Moroccan nationalist movement, Alal al-Fassi, he himself was an Islamic modernist. And so I would say that there was more support for Islamic modernism, and that it was more visible ideology. But there was still conversation, and Alal al-Fassi, part of Islamic modernism is this fear that society will be split into two spheres. One that just accepts anything, any innovation as a positive move, and one that rejects all newness as a negative innovation. And Alal al-Fassi really saw his role as to try and reconcile and encourage communication between, you know, two spheres. So the sphere educated by Europeans and the sphere educated by traditional Islamic schools or Arabic language schools. And he essentially fails, right? The split happens, and it will eventually become two totally separate political parties.
Okay. So we're now in the 1960s. The king passed away in 1961, writing the 1962 Constitution, and the king is becoming more autocratic as time marches on. There's something else that's going on in the world, too, that plays a big role here, and that is the Cold War. The U.S. and Western Europe, they're concerned about the expansion of communism, socialism, and countries are aligning with the Soviet Union, and this is starting to cause a great deal of consternation amongst policy circles. Morocco seems to be a fairly critical geographically located country right there at the end point or pinch point between the Mediterranean Sea and the Atlantic Ocean. So did the Cold War affect what was going on domestically in Morocco during the 1960s.
Absolutely, and both in terms of the relationship between Morocco and other countries and in terms of the relationship domestically between the regime and opposition movements. From the American side, Morocco was really seen as an opportunity. There was a lot of discussion after World War II on how long it had taken to set up bases in Europe, and there was this idea that Morocco could solve this problem in future conflicts. I actually found one document in the Digital National Security Archives which said Morocco could be the, quote, new base of allied relations in the event of World War III. Mm. So Morocco was really seen as, all of North Africa was seen as significant in the post-World War II period, but Morocco was really seen as the most significant because it was close enough to Europe that radio traffic could reach it. And as you pointed out, it's also right at the mouth of the Mediterranean. So really seen as this country that had a very strategic location and was obviously the closest in terms of distance to the United States. On the domestic side, as I mentioned earlier, the fear of the left is in some ways conditioned by the international environment. So Nasser comes to power in Egypt. There's this sense that the left is really gaining ground across North Africa. The Soviet Union, I can't remember the year, but makes some sort of public statement where, you know, it claims, like, we're going to go out and we're going to, you know, take socialism, you know, across North Africa all the way to Indonesia. So there's this kind of threat that socialism is spreading across the world. And the Moroccan regime is really afraid of the rise of the left. They have destabilized other countries. And not only the 1965 protests in Casablanca, but then the 1968 protests in France, which really destabilized or paused kind of government relations in France for weeks, really contributed to and encouraged this idea that not only is the left a threat in the local sense or in the Moroccan context, but the left will have access to resources outside of Morocco, both ideological and financial. Mm-hmm. And so there was a real sense of urgency that the left must be contained. And that was, you know, tied intimately to the context of the Cold War.
So you have this king who is thinking about, I'm the, you know, supreme leader of Islam here, so taking on a much more theocratic flavor to his increasingly autocratic regime. He sees the threat of the left, the Cold War growing, and some influence there by the United States in the geopolitical situation. Then there's these 1965 Casablanca riots, and you make a big deal about this, calling this a critical juncture in the history of modern Morocco, and especially with respect to some of the things that you are looking at, educational reforms as well as control of the public discourse in other arenas. What happens in these 1965 Casablanca riots?
Basically, the Moroccan Ministry of Education comes out with a ruling that's going to limit educational opportunities for students above the age of 17. And this creates a lot of public outcry because part of the discourse of becoming an independent country is that there's this leveling of the playing field. Like, all people will have access to equal opportunities. Education under the French protectorate prior to 1956 was not open equally to all Moroccans. Only the Moroccan elite had access to educational institutions. So in this first decade of Moroccan independence, any effort to limit access to education was created a lot of fear among people. And, you know, honestly, I think Moroccan political parties kind of played this up or tried to capitalize on this. And the left in particular mobilized high school students at Mohammed V Casablanca High School in Casablanca, to march, to protest about these educational reforms. And it allowed people to really express frustrations they had about other issues, you know, rising prices, instability. And one of the ways that you can see that this is a larger than an educational issue is that Moroccan students were frequently joined by their parents. Their parents took the streets with them. Mm. And in the initial day of protest, March 22nd, 1965, students were dispersed without violence. So there's like a strong stand by the by the regime, you know, the army shows up and disperses people, but it's not really a violent interaction. The next day, the students regather on the soccer field outside Muhammad V High School and march a second time, and this time they're angry. You know, they're angry that they didn't feel heard from the day before. They're angry they were dispersed without being able to finish the planned route of their march. And they express it in very violent ways. They burn cars. They break into buildings. It's more kind of chaotic mob violence. But the regime brings out tanks and artillery. I mean, there's a real over response that I think kind of captures this instability or fear that Hassan II was feeling early on in his regime, his need to really say, you know, no, I'm in control here. And so he comes out shooting to make it, to say the least. And there's a news blockout. It's very difficult to get information about the 1965 riots. There's virtually no scholarship. People are leery to talk about the events that happened because they initiate this period that is known in Morocco as the Years of Lead, where there was the disappearance of political dissidents, torture, assassinations, a real closing of political space. And so I call it a critical juncture because it demonstrates both to the regime and to opposition movements how important not only students are, but educational institutions. Education obviously is something that gets people riled up. It will bring them to the streets. They're willing to protest about it. Political parties realize that they can mobilize high school students. The regime realizes that they can't just allow students to think what they want. They need to be involved in the formation of students' ideology at this really key point. The other thing that the protest demonstrated, because there was only one university at the time, in 1965, students from all over Morocco were coming to the same university. And so when they went home, this could allow like a spreading of an ideology across an entire country very quickly. Whatever environment or whatever ideology was popular at the university would spread across the country in the summers when students would go home.
And this, this university was in Casablanca?
No, this university was in Rabat, but Rabat and Casablanca are about a 45-minute train route from one another, and so there was a lot of interaction with students, and a lot of university students went to the protests in Casablanca and then hosted kind of copycat protests in the coming days in cities across the country.
Okay, so the regime is immediately going to see, whoa, this is spreading to all sorts of places, to the university, and then once those university students go home, it's going to be in every city.
Right, and it does.
Okay, it does spread. So you mentioned a number of things, that the regime responds, as many authoritarian regimes throughout the world at this point in time respond likewise, with political disappearances, assassinations, torture, the whole thing. Let's focus on education, because that is something that oftentimes goes underplayed, and this is really the strength of your dissertation, and I think what was going to make it a very interesting book when it eventually comes out, to focus on how education is actually used to condition political outcomes. And it's important, as we mentioned earlier, too, that not many political scientists look at the role of education as an important factor of conditioning these political outcomes. So let's discuss that for a minute. Why is education important? And this is not just for Morocco. This is just for general polities.
Well, I think this question has been taken in all sorts of directions. The one I'm going to choose to focus on is the ability for education to institutionalize a conflict and then have influence over time. What do I mean? Imagine a context similar to Morocco, where there are two groups fighting, you know, vaguely the Islamists and the leftists. And let's say they have virtually the same amount of adherence, 50%, 50%. And an educational curriculum is negotiated between the two of them. It's a compromise. That curriculum is going to be used year after year until there's another reform. And let's say one group greatly increases in power and the other one doesn't. Yet, over time, that curriculum is still going to be reflective of the conflict that took place at the time of the reform. So in my dissertation, I claim that education has path-dependent effects. It continues to recreate a conflict, even perhaps after the conditions of that conflict have passed or are not active any longer. So my interest with education is how, over time, what was once a small, perhaps, conflict or quibble can be magnified or can be spread or can have, you know, as we discussed earlier, unintended consequences because students year after year will experience that curriculum.
That is a really good point, because one of the things that has puzzled me a lot, and I've thought about educational reforms in the light of Catholic education in the United States and Latin America and a few other places, is that education usually deals with the socialization of the young, starting, I don't know, 5, 6 years old or so and continuing on. And the way I've always viewed it is that this socialization tends to have a very long-term effect to it. And in some of these nations, as we talked about in Morocco in 1956 and in 1957 and 58, it's an uncertain environment. And even when King Hassan comes to power and starts increasing his grasp over society, there's still a lot of uncertainty. And we've understood in political science that many of these dictators, even if they rule with an iron fist, oftentimes have very short-term time horizons. They're worried about the near term. Are they going to be in office next month, next week, or maybe even tomorrow? And so they tend to neglect long-term policies. And so I could never square this, is that, well, educational reform is something that has a long-term policy to it. But what you just said, it strikes me. This is something I never thought about before. And you know, another great reason why your research is bringing something new to the table is that you're right. You know, education does have that long-term socialization effect, but it crystallizes a moment like a riot, mm-hmm. like some major event, and says, this is the curriculum that's going to go forth now. And King Hassan must be looking at this in March and then in April and May saying, whoa, this is what we have to look forward for the next couple of years. We better do something about it. So that's essentially what you're talking about, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think maybe I should bring up a second point here, which is I think education is interesting in an authoritarian context for a particular reason. In authoritarian contexts, everything is political, right? And in some cases, when a political environment is very closed, what's going on, say, in an election campaign might not be the real place where ideological contestation is taking place, right? There's this need to pay deference to particular norms. You know you're not allowed to say certain things. That might be a very kind of polite ideological conflict compared to areas that are seen as less distinctly political. And so I think in an authoritarian context, education is a really interesting place to see how ideological conflicts are fought out, because people who have, people who are true, you know, we'll use the term again, like politologues, are going to be very invested in the type of ideology that are being taught to students. And so they might be more willing to voice their real opinions or to take risks to influence an educational curriculum that they might not be willing to do on the national stage, it's more likely to end up on the front page of the newspaper. It's more likely to be censored. It could bring them more kind of flack from the regime. And if they're being, you know, monitored or censored, it could be more dangerous. So I think in an authoritarian context, education has a particular role. And then even beyond that, in a particular subset of regimes, what we would call competitive authoritarian regimes, these are authoritarian countries that want to look democratic. So they use democratic institutions, but at the end of the day, you know, the ruler is still making all the decisions. They might have a legislature, they might have elections, they might have appointed and elected positions, but at the end of the day, power is effectively held by the authoritarian ruler. And these places, I think they have a particular interest in politicizing education. Why? Because they're allowing these opportunities for the opposition to contest, right? They're allowing elections. So it's in their interest that these don't become really virulent ideological contests. And that's why I think competitive authoritarian regimes in particular are going to politicize education in a particular way to prevent ideological contestation that would either, you know, unite an opposition movement and perhaps threaten their authority or just cause them a lot of problems that they don't want to have to deal with. So I think I think education is politicized in every context. I think in authoritarian contexts, it might be a place to look for more, quote, real ideological contestation. And in competitive authoritarian regimes, I think in an effort to look democratic, a regime might need to employ education to manipulate ideological contestation because they're allowing a degree of ideological conflict already, and they want to have control over how strong individual movements are to protect their own authority.
So let's go ahead and look at some of the specifics of what occurs after these 1965 Casablanca riots. What are the reforms going on, and how quickly do they kick in? Does this happen on, you know, April 1st, you know, oh, we just had a week of riots, we better start instituting reform, or does it take several months or a year, and how does this progress?
Oh, this takes years. This process takes years. I wouldn't say that the curriculum has kind of been fully harnessed to this ideological project until the 1980s. Of course, there are some initial incidents to suggest that education had been involved in this project. We see the closing of philosophy and sociology departments, and the which are seen as centers of leftist ideology at both the Moroccan University and in Moroccan high schools. That's earlier in the 70s, but we don't really see the unification of the curriculum against the left until the 1980s.
Mm-hmm. So what other types of reforms are going on here? I mean, closing philosophy departments, I think I could live with that. But yeah. Not political science departments, but philosophy, you look to them, right? No. That's so they close. I mean, obviously, immediately they weed out the radicals. And this is probably part of the disappearances and torture that goes on here. But what else goes on in terms of curriculum? Is there somebody sitting saying, well, we got to start changing what we're teaching? And what is the content of that?
Yeah, I look at three different forms of reform.
Okay.
Institutional, leadership, and curriculum. So what institutions, what universities, what institutes, what schools are funded and which ones aren't, and which are given prestige and which aren't, which are given new buildings and which aren't. I look at leadership, you know, who is put in control of the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Islamic Affairs, the different universities or institutes.
Does that actually trickle down to the teachers themselves as well? I mean, you, obviously the Minister of Education is going to be very important and who's ever heading up the universities and the principals of high schools. But I mean, is there a very self-selective process in terms of these are the teachers that we want?
Well, this happens in two ways. I would say intentional and unintentionally. Intentionally the curriculum is Arabized. So there's a move to teach as many subjects as possible in the Arabic language, kind of a response to French education prior to independence, which was taught in French.
Mm-hmm.
But through the process of moving an entire country's public school curriculum to be taught in a different language, there's a huge need for teachers who speak Arabic, and the Moroccans simply can't fill it. And so they begin importing teachers from Syria, Iraq, Egypt, and with them comes particular ideologies. So one aspect of this, like who is teaching, is unintentionally ideological because of the need to import teachers. And since subjects that would be taught in Arabic, such as Arabic language and literature or Islamic education, would attract people who are very concerned with religion, what it ends up doing is importing a number of Salafists to Morocco. And this is realized, and eventually there's complete cutoff. No foreign teachers are allowed in Morocco. But at first, it's not. Secondly, unintentionally, I have mixed data about this. In a number of interviews, I was told that Moroccan Islamic education teachers tended to be Salafists or having a Salafist interpretation of Islam. But I can't substantiate that with the data that I have. But I have been told that in interviews.
Just very quickly, explain what Salafism is for our listeners.
Well, we talked about Islamic modernism in the independence movement. That, I would say, is the ideological foundation for Salafism. But there's a difference. Islamic modernists, when I talked about Alal al-Fassi, the nationalist leader earlier, I talked about his kind of desire to stand in the gap between what he saw as two spheres of society and to try and help them to work out their differences. And so there'd be this kind of synthesis between, like, the wisdom of Islam and, you know, scientific advances, right? But with Salafism, there's much more antagonism towards non-Islamic institutions and, like, technological advances. And this varies, you know. I'm not going to be able to capture the variation that exists within Salafism today. But there's this move. Salaf comes from the Arabic word for pious ancestors. And so there's this sense that the ideal Muslim community takes the first four generations of Muslims as their reference point, as the ideal Muslim community. And so modern-day Salafists, you know, try to live as closely as they can in line with the behavior of those people. And they also base their, you know, interpretation of Islam on a set of texts.
So we have an understanding of Salafism right now. And as you mentioned, your data is somewhat ambiguous about what the actual theological content of this was. But going back to the reforms, we talked about institutional reforms, which schools get funding and which ones don't. That's a huge carrot and stick right there to guide reform one direction or the other. You talked about leadership, who's going to be in control at the very top. And this has some trickle-down effect as well as encouraging the people from abroad to come in. And then curriculum. So you said the curriculum is Arabicized. What else happens in the curriculum?
Well, if we're going to look solely at the Islamic education curriculum for a moment, the religious instruction in the public schools, there's a real move to kind of subsidize Salafism. So great Salafist thinkers are invoked in the text, even Moroccan Salafists or scholars seen as the foundation for Moroccan Salafism. But perhaps more fundamentally, Islam is set up as a political ideology in conflict with other ideologies.
Mm-hmm.
So Islam is not taught as a religion in the public schools. It's taught as an all-encompassing system that requires certain political beliefs. Islam is set up as contrary to Zionism, contrary to capitalism, contrary to communism, contrary to socialism. There's a very antagonistic language used, especially in the 1980s and 1990s, to suggest that if you're a, quote, good Muslim, you will not have these other political beliefs.
So that, I can imagine, is a way to cut the leftist off at the pass.
Mm-hmm.
And say, okay, you had your leftist stuff, but here's the alternative. We're going to get these kids early. We're also going to control the dialogue after these 1965 riots, make sure this doesn't happen again. Is this successful in limiting leftist influence?
Absolutely. And of course, combined with the other aspects of this strategy that we're not really focused on in this conversation, the left is really, as I said earlier, one scholar calls it exhausted by this series of reforms. One way that this is demonstrated in reference to the anecdote I mentioned at the beginning was the Moroccan Student Union, UNEM, which was started by leftists, for leftists, to train leftists, is today completely controlled by Islamists on university campuses, to the point where they can really stop classes whenever they want. They can call for a strike and require, you know, an entire classroom, an entire university campus to shut down. So they're an incredibly powerful, powerful group.
Let me ask this. Given that there's this effort to shut down leftist opposition to what King Hassan is doing and his autocratic regime, is there any opportunistic jumping ship by the leftist into the Islamic camp? Because it seems that, okay, fine, if you're going to create this new curriculum, we'll play along, we'll just jump into it so that we can guide it along our ways, and might this have some unintended consequences down the road?
Oh, certainly. There are specific individuals one can point to who were leaders in the leftist movement and become leaders in the Islamist movement. And this happens, you know, internationally, not just in Morocco. But a number of the leaders who arise in various Islamist movements either were not involved with the left or claimed to have some sort of conversion or some realization that, you know, the left was unable to offer, you know, the goods that they thought it could. So there is a degree of disillusionment with the left that some people use to explain their shift. And so I don't have a means of saying, you know, whether those were valid or, you know, heartfelt conversions or not, but there certainly is leadership from the one that arises in the second. Yeah,
as you mentioned, this does happen region-wide. You see this, the locus of opposition shifting from left-wing opposition to more religious base, especially with the failures of secular governments, say of you know, Nasser's regime. And it's like, well, you had great promise, but nothing came of this. And you see the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood as a means of rectifying some of what they saw was secular excesses in that regard. This, the title of your dissertation, or tentative title of your dissertation, talks about from Islamist solution to Islamic problem. And so we see with these educational reforms, the Islamist solution, let's start reemphasizing a different curriculum, different leadership, and encourage institutions to go this direction to cut off leftists. Where do we get an Islamist problem then?
Right. Let me just clarify that for listeners who can't read this, that the title is An Islamic IC Solution Leads to an Islamist IST Problem.
Okay.
And I have been pushed on this matter before, because I'm not really trying to take a normative judgment and say that the rise of Islam is a problem in Moroccan political discourse. But I am trying to point out how the regime didn't get what it wanted. I think what it wanted was a divided opposition that had infighting, right? And so the left is very powerful. Let's kind of subsidize Islamist ideologies, and then that will weaken the left, and they'll fight amongst themselves and not turn against the regime and force real reform. And so when I say Islamist problem, I'm trying to highlight how, because their solution was maybe more successful than they want it to be, and I think that is in some ways related to the larger international environment, because a number of Islamist groups mobilized to the point where they can challenge the regime in very noticeable ways, that the regime would see their Islamic solution as an Islamist problem. And I think this is most evident in the rise of Abdus-Salam Yassin's movement. He is a former Islamic education teacher and education inspector who started his own social movement and refuses to participate in politics because he views the Moroccan political system as illegitimate. So his believers don't participate in politics in the sense that they frequently boycott elections, but they can bring more people to the streets than anyone else. I think this was demonstrated in marches against proposed changes to some family code legislation early in the 21st century in Morocco. I want to say that the Islamists are believed to have brought, you know, over 1 million protesters, and the other side was only able to bring something like 50,000 people to their protests. And yet, because of the environment, because of the post-2003 fear of Islamists, this legislation was pushed through anyways, even though the kind of most active social movement in Morocco opposed it. Secondly, the interesting thing about the Moroccan case is that this group, Justice and Charity, led by Yassin, was for many years, I would say, the main group fighting for democratization in Morocco. They were the ones saying, you know, we do not have a constitutional monarchy. We have an authoritarian system. Our elections are, you know, do not confer real authority on elected officials. And so we're not even going to participate in this system because, in a sense, that would legitimize it.
Mm-hmm. And you can see some of these tendencies or trends in other places, such as Algeria, a little bit earlier during the time. When does the regime, this increasingly authoritarian regime, start to see Islamism as a problem? And again, I do want to clarify this for our listeners. You're not making any kind of judgment call in terms of Islamist problem. You're saying from the perception of the regime, from the eyes right. of the rulers in power, this is a problem. It's not one that they anticipated. It's a problem. So when do they start seeing this as problematic? Is this apparent in the 1980s, 1990s?
When? I would say in the 1990s, Hassan II, his health is declining and the public is aware of it. And I think he starts to have real fears that he is leaving his son with a quote-unquote Islamist problem. And so in 1998, there's a period in Morocco called alternance, or when the left was brought in to govern. So they were, in the Moroccan system, when you win, prior to the 2011 constitutional reforms, even if your party wins legislative elections, you don't necessarily give in the prime ministership. The king decides who is the prime minister. And so it's somewhat blatant when the left is put in power in 1998 that the king is attempting to revive the left.
Yeah, this seems as if you almost you tried one medicine and you overdosed on that, so you're now going to try the antidote, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And it really fails. I mean, Alternance fails in all sorts of ways, but he's really unable to revive the left in any kind of meaningful way. And so rather than try to spend more time trying to revive the left, the emphasis shifts to how can we contain and reframe what it means to be a Moroccan Muslim in ways that are apolitical. And so the final few chapters of the dissertation look at how rather than subsidizing Salafism, the regime now subsidizes Islamic mysticism or Sufism, mm-hmm. and particular Bushishi brotherhoods. So there's this encouragement from the regime in the same ways that I mentioned earlier, institutions, leadership, curriculum, to encourage Moroccans to be Sufis and to embrace what they would say is a quote-unquote tolerant Islam.
Mm-hmm. And this, so in 1998, they invite the leftists in, and that fails. And I can only imagine this is going to get some of the Islamic or Islamist opposition rather irritated. So,
oh yeah, that's why it failed.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, what are you doing? That's blatant wrong. Yeah. But does this increase in intensity after, say, September 11th, and bring us up to the 2003 Casablanca bombings?
So you're asking if the
So essentially, what I'm asking is the regime. Hassan is getting in his elder years. He's going to pass on, and he says, "I don't want to leave my sons with this mess." So we're going to try to create an antidote to the problem that we created before. Let's bring some leftists in. Oh, that fails. So now we're going to turn to Sufism. But then September 11th occurs, and
we're missing one event in Moroccan history, which is significant, and that's the death of Hassan II.
Oh, when did he die?
1999.
Okay.
And his son, Mohammed VI, coming to power with great fanfare and great expectation. There was this idea that he would be the democratizing king, and he encouraged this perspective. And I remember, and he really charmed Western media. I remember one Time news article on him called him the king of cool. So he was really seen as someone who could really bring change to Morocco. And I think early in his regime, he was intending to, but 9/11 and 2003, kind of similarly to 1965 for his father, really scare the pants off of him. And there's a real closing of political space in the post-2003 period. One scholar jokes that anyone with a beard was put in jail post-2003.
Explain what happened in 2003 with the bombings. I do remember this, but it oftentimes gets lost here, especially in the American media, with all the other events that occur in our country or in Europe.
True. Yeah, there was a bombing, several bombings in Casablanca, which were coordinated, the most deadly at a restaurant frequented by the Jewish community in Casablanca, and a number were killed. And I think what's most significant about the event is really the regime's response. So this immediate crackdown on anyone conceived of being an Islamist, and a number of people were put, and we're talking thousands of people were put in jail without trial. And this would resurface later in the Arab Spring protests in Morocco.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned again, following a similar playbook that was done in 1965 and shortly thereafter, there's this encouragement of Sufism, which is, as you mentioned, a more seen as a more tolerant, more mystical strand of Islam. Are there any other actions? I mean, obviously the crackdown too, but are there any other actions that Morocco has been engaged in to try to deal with this Islamist problem as they see it between 2003 and, say, about 2009, 2010?
Well, I mean, it certainly starts before then, but there is this de-Islamization of the school curriculum, if we're to focus on education. So this is the removing of Islamic content from all sorts of classes. It wasn't just, Islamic education classes that had an Islamic reference. It was Islamic civilization classes, Arabic language and literature, philosophy. When it was brought back into the Moroccan curriculum, was based on and rooted in the study of Islamic philosophers. So there was, starting in the 1990s, but really accelerating in the post-2003 period, there's this removal of Islamic content from a number of subjects, so that the curriculum itself has much, much less of a religious basis. And then the Islamic education classes themselves, there was an effort early on to reduce the number of hours of Islamic education, and this became a huge conflict between the interest groups that had grown up around the teaching of Islam in the public schools and those reformers who wanted to use those hours for more math, more science, more English, you know, other subjects. And so what the regime does, I think, is really impressive and shrewd. I mean, if one is an authoritarian ruler, they maintain the same number of hours, essentially, but they de-Islamize, they remove the Islamic content even from the Islamic education curriculum, to the point now that a lot of the classes they're on either banal subjects like inheritance, so if so-and-so dies and she has this much money and she has this many kids, what does she interpret? Or what does she inherit? Or there's this move to discuss tolerance, communication, forgiveness, you know, like inter-religious relations. So in a sense, the students aren't receiving Islamic education in the traditional sense at all anymore. It's more of like citizenship training.
Yeah, that's really got to suck if you're the younger brother of some kid or younger sister, and that your 15-year-old brother has all the notes from the past classes and all of a sudden the education shifts. It's like, oh, I was hoping to benefit from that. But yeah, now everything's different. Okay. But where are we now in terms of Morocco? And you said you were there in 2010, 2011, right there when the Arab Spring gets started, where it starts in Tunisia and then starts to spread across the region. What is Morocco looking like today?
Well, right now, the party that's governing is PJD, the Party of Justice and Democracy. They are a vaguely Salafist political party that's pro-democracy, although they, you know, dabble in issues they probably shouldn't as a party. But they're internally democratic, so they elect their leadership in accordance with democratic standards. They're currently in a governing position, and so this is kind of a first in the sense that a group that had been in the opposition is being given a chance to govern, and obviously with the left in the late 1990s, this ends up discrediting them because they're not able to do anything, and it just further weakens them. So there's some question about perhaps maybe the regime wanted PJD to come to power to further discredit the Islamists when they'll be unable to do anything, because as I said before, they have access to very little influence, very little power.
And is this a response in many ways to the Arab Spring, that Mohammed VI, who I assume still is the king, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. He's looking at this. He says, whoa, there's this big wave going across the region, and we had better get on this wave and control it, lest it subsume us, because, well, Mubarak is gone and Gaddafi is gone and the Tunisian ruler is gone and Assad is not doing too well in Syria right now. Is there some essence to try to harness what is going on in the region at wide in Morocco by engaging in some democratic reforms?
I would not say that there had been democratic reforms.
Okay.
In line with kind of previous efforts, I would say there's a real PR campaign on behalf of the Moroccans to look democratic. But at the end of the day, the regime is not restrained by its constitution or by any sharing of powers with other institutions. And so the regime, in my opinion, maintains, is somewhat solidly democratic, but is limited more by international public opinion and the desire to appear reforming and democratic. And so I think the behavior is a bit shrewder on behalf of the king, but at lower levels. So in my research in the Ministry of Education, I was really struck by the kind of internally democratic standards that people are setting in positions of authority within the ministry. Say, for example, the committees which select the curriculum or write the textbooks. nowadays set internally democratic standards, autonomous merit-based review of texts, negotiation over, when there's conflict about curriculum, no political appointees on committees. They're all experts in the field of Islamic education. And so I think from below, there is movement towards democratization in ways that, in people's own individual spheres. But at the highest levels, I would not say that there had been any significant sharing of power.
Mm-hmm. We're just about out of time here, and I want to leave you some space to reflect upon what you are learning in your specific study of Morocco and the educational reforms there in relation to the authoritarian regime and possibilities for democratization. For the region as a whole, or maybe for even comparative politics as a whole, I'm not going to ask you to speculate about the future of Morocco. You're a young graduate student in your career, and any kind of speculation you leave on the internet is always out there. I sometimes ask my guests to do that, but I will spare you that. But what have you learned from your research and from your experiences there that tell us a little bit more about what is going on politically in the region writ large?
Good question. Well, I mean, at the risk of saying things everyone already knows, I think people are willing to put up with less than they were in the past. So, as an example from the Moroccan case, I had never heard public criticism of the king until 2011. And I started working in Morocco in 2006, so that's not really a huge time frame, 5 years.
Yeah.
But I do think that the protest movements have led people to feel like they have a right to express their frustration. I think this is extremely significant. To follow Samuel Huntington's line, I think with rising expectations, there is the risk of rising instability. And I think, we're kind of witnessing that at the moment, that now that people feel the willingness to express themselves, the frustration at feeling not listened to, since they've taken the risks of expression, is going to lead to, a period of extreme instability in the region. And I think rulers are getting away with increasingly less, but I think we still see this dynamic where if an authoritarian ruler is willing to kind of quote-unquote keep his population under control, other powers, specifically Western powers, will parade around pretending like this person is one of our allies and the democratic reformer. And maybe in some senses they are an ally, but I think it's going to become increasingly unpalatable for American foreign policymakers to claim that certain rulers are democratic when their population is expressing such virulent kind of outrage. So I think this is going to have implications for American foreign policy.
Well, that would open up another can of worms of that we don't necessarily want to go into, but it is something that we do want to watch, and we'll have to keep our eye on the events in Morocco as they develop over the course of months and years, and we'll most definitely have you back at some point in time to see how things are progressing. So, Anne, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.